Welcome to the Guffman. I'm Alex. James will be joining me shortly. I just wanted to mention a couple things off the top of this podcast. This episode is about I'm Not There, a movie I love very much, and I somehow neglected to mention my favorite thing about this movie in the hour plus talking about it. I think it's just because it's something that I've talked about so much over the years, and specifically with James, that I think it was just kind of an implied bed of all under all of the thoughts that I project throughout this episode. And that James already knew, but I neglected to remember that sometimes a couple other people listen to this podcast. So anyways, I'll make this quick. When I first saw the movie in 2007, I knew little to nothing about Bob Dylan. I mean, you can't exist in North American culture and be interested in pop culture while knowing nothing about him, but I didn't know a lot. And so when I came to this movie, I was just sort of seeing it as, I don't even know how I was approaching it. It was just a movie I felt compelled to see, probably because I was really interested in Christian Bale or had a good trailer or something like that, or just because I saw everything by that point in my life. And the one thing that I felt the most strongly about in that viewing in 2007 was that it was kind of a biopic, but it was a biopic in a way that sort of felt like it was about everybody. Like the way the movie shows that is through the split persona. You know, we've got Richard Gere, Cate Blanchett, and four other people playing some facet of Bob Dylan. The movie was about how, you know, you change a lot over your life, and I change a lot over my life. You know, I first saw this movie in 2007, and parts of that viewing still resonate with me in 2016, but also totally different things resonate with me as well, just because I have nine extra years of existence to think back about and that have affected me. And that's the thing I like the most about the movie. It's simultaneously something I know I will love pretty much every year for the rest of my life, but it's also something that I might have a totally different opinion on or a totally new opinion on if I were to watch it again in another 9 years, you know? And I think that's a really cool, wonderful thing to accomplish that this movie absolutely does. And I would be remiss if I somehow released this podcast without that idea being in there. So, I mean, this movie is what this movie is. Todd Haynes probably has a totally different feeling about the movie as I do. You probably have a totally different feeling about the movie as I do. And that's kind of the beautiful thing about the movie, right? You can like what you like, you can dislike what you like, but a movie walks on its own.
Oh, the rag man draws circles up and down the black. I'd ask him what the matter was, but I know that he don't talk. And the ladies,
James.
She's a kindly.
Yep.
What are we talking about here?
Keeping that versus thing going.
Yeah. Bob versus Bob versus Bob versus Bob versus Bob.
That's right.
Dawn of abstraction.
The many lives and faces of Bob Dylan.
Exactly.
Yeah, we're talking about I'm Not There.
Yeah, the movie has a better title than our fake title for it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Directed by Todd Haynes, a 2007 movie, written by Todd Haynes and Oren Boverman.
Yeah.
Some hot introductory
details.
From
my understanding, kind of, a bit of a long time in the making from what I understood.
Yeah, it seems like all of Todd Haynes' movies take forever to come together. Like, Carol, he joined it late in the production, but had he joined onto that in, like, 2013. But the screenwriter of that movie had already been attached to it for 15 years, you know? Like, it just seems like he finds a way to, and I mean, looking at his career, like, it's correct. He finds himself drawn to movies that are kind of difficult to get through. Well, not get through that. I mean, because I mean, you're gonna find it. It's gonna be very clear that I fucking love I'm Not There very quickly. But but it's not.
Some would describe it as hard to get through.
Yeah, for sure. Some people have been yelled at for me for describing it that way. But it's just sort of like more difficult films to watch. You know, like. Less spoon-feeding than a lot of Hollywood films, and or the topics are about things that are not typically covered in Hollywood filmmaking, and I think because of that, sometimes he has a hard time getting his movies made. Yeah,
Yeah, did you see the one-page synopsis that he wrote for Bob Dylan to approve the use of his music in this?
I know I read it like a couple years ago when I was thinking about this movie, but I don't really remember it.
Okay, well, his producer, Bob Dylan's manager, asked Todd Haynes to write a one-page synopsis before Bob Dylan would give anyone permission to use his music.
Yeah, he said make sure not to use Voice of a Generation, right?
Genius or Voice of a Generation,
which is wonderful advice.
Yeah, and you know, I want to read the one page synopsis just because it ties in so well with what you're saying about this not being a spoon feeding kind of movie.
Yeah.
I love it. I think it's so funny.
Yeah.
If a film were to exist in which the breadth and flux of a creative life could be experienced, a film that could open up as opposed to consolidating what we already think we know we're walking into, it could never be within the tidy arc of a master narrative. That's the opening sentence. I mean, and it just kind of goes on from there.
Yeah.
I won't read the whole thing. Anyone who wants it, find it. But it's that... you know, just I think it summed up so well with that brief part of the sentence, a film that can open up as opposed to consolidating what we think we know. I think with biopics so often, and I even have a hard time calling this a biopic, but I think it applies in a way.
Todd Haynes does consider this movie a biopic.
Right, but
yeah,
it's
just for the record,
it's just different.
Yeah,
yeah. It's I think the difficult part I imagine in undertaking a biopic is taking someone's whole career and turning it into 90 minutes. Taking someone who not only lived a long life but also lived a life that, you know, had creative pursuits for multiple decades, and to try to turn that into something cohesive, I imagine, is the big challenge. And this one doesn't even pretend to try to do that. you know, I think it does a good job of presenting different parts of his life and different facets of his music. But yeah, you know, that phrase, as opposed to consolidating, I think this one kind of refracts the story of Bob Dylan, not to say to distort it, but to kind of elucidate all the different threads that kind of run throughout it. And as we see in this movie, more so in other parts than in some parts than others, he really kind of rejects the idea of being summed up. So it's a pretty wise way to try to tell someone's story, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it's easily my favorite biopic. I'm sure we've talked about my I don't know if we've actually done a podcast on a biopic, but I'm sure we've talked about my disdain for them has slipped in here or there. And this movie is especially, I mean, it's coming out a couple years after Ray was 2004 and Walk the Line was 2005, where when Walk the Line came out, I just sort of felt like, well, I guess we're just going to get these movies that are gunning for Best Actor and Best Actresses nominations every single year, you know, like where it's just going to be the womb to tomb sort of biopic. And I generally feel most biopics are they just aren't inventive, you know. And this is a very inventive film, and tells a story in what I find to be a unique way. And I mean, when I first saw this movie, I knew, I don't want to say nothing, but I want to say slightly more than nothing about Bob Dylan. And I still feel like the movie had and I'm not any Bob Dylan expert now, but this movie still had a big effect on me. And I loved this movie. I loved it when I first saw it. And then I think I saw it twice in theaters, and then watched it once when it came out on DVD. And then just sort of like put it away as this sort of like perfect movie that I just never wanted to tarnish my experience with. And then I just watched it again like earlier this year, and have now watched it 5 times in this calendar year and could definitely go for it again. Like, it's just, I don't know, it's a really rewarding movie, regardless of what you think about Bob Dylan, at least for a certain kind of person like myself, you know. Like, I think it's so good, and is about so many things simultaneously. And despite, as you said, it's this kind of refraction of a story, I think there are so many ways that the movie ties in together, and it's totally unique. Even Velvet Goldmine, which is another Todd Haynes movie, it's his David Bowie, Iggy Pop movie, which he didn't have any rights for, so he had to change all the names and make up new songs and all that stuff. But like, even that, it looks like amateur work in comparison to I'm Not There. Like, it's just, I don't know. I feel like sometimes you see a movie where you're just like, oh, this is, the director's never going to top this. And like, he's never going to top this. It's so good. Yeah.
Right. Do you want to elaborate a bit more on this versus another biopic, or do you think you kind of got that out of there just being kind of more inventive and just telling the story, you know, from their childhood to their death? Yeah. Or, you know,
yeah, it's really
how old the person is when the movie's made about them. I'm just kind of plucking the six most notable things that the Wikipedia page would talk about and then making that a movie.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I mean, I mentioned Ray and Walk the Line earlier. Those are both movies that are released towards the end of their subject's life. I believe Ray Charles died during the production of Ray, or very near the end of it. And I think Johnny Cash died like a year or two after Walk the Line came out. And it, as such, you get kind of a whole life sort of look at them, even though you skip the last 40 years typically, which, you know, which I'm Not There kind of does as well, but where, you know, you get their childhood a little bit, and what was the defining sadness that pushed them ahead, like what gave them the leg up. Ray Charles's brother, I think, gets sawed in half, I think that's what it is, in Ray, and which, yeah, memorialized in Walk,
Dewey Cox,
Walk Hard, there it is.
Your boy's cut in half pretty good.
I might be mixing them up, and Ray Charles's brother, his brother definitely dies very young, but anyway, and then that's the defining thing, and then they've got their rise, and you get those really fun like scenes of them composing music and recording in the studio, and then inevitably they get too into drugs, and then somebody has to make them go to rehab, and then eventually their career falls on the rocks. They have a divorce, maybe two, and then things kind of get generally okay, and they turn 50, and then the movie cuts to black, and we get like an epigraph at the end. It's like, Ray Charles was regarded as one of the finest musicians of his time, and then you get that slow motion footage of the person Ray Charles playing the piano, and it just sort of fades out, which I think is how Ray ends. You know, it was just a very, it's kind of like the easiest way to tell the story is to make it the most, as you said, Wikipedia-y style of their biography, where you just pick the facts that you would feel are major, and then you tell them in a chronological, for the most part, way. And it's kind of boring. Like, the biopic-ish type things that are more interesting to me are things like 8 Mile, which is kind of a biopic, kind of not, but also kind of very on brand with where the star was at the time, Eminem being the star in question there, where you kind of fictionalize their life but also kind of don't, and you don't show necessarily them hitting success. You just sort of focus on one portion of the life, you know, where and you can have a defined story in there that's not, that doesn't have to move so quickly that you throw in so many details at rapid fire pace. You know, you don't have to have as many montages just to get your information across.
Yeah, and I can't remember specifically because it's been a while, but I feel like 8 Mile takes place within a few weeks, a few months, you know?
Oh, I think it's weeks, yeah.
Yeah, not as sprawling as these other ones.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this movie's definitely different than, you know, Ray, Walk the Line. Just, you know, we obviously have different actors playing this character. We have, you know, different periods of their lives set in different places. And I mean, this sounds silly, but is this movie that fundamentally different than those? I mean, we still have a child and kind of traumatic experience with the bridge near drowning. Mm-hmm. We have the rise to fame. We have the divorce. We have the, you know, drug problems. What is it that is so much different that it really makes you appreciate this?
I think the fragmentation of it is, I think, kind of... adds a lot because it's sort of, it turns it from being about this person to being about all of these people, right? And then it's very easy to sort of project yourself or other people you know into the movie. Like Jude, well, and I guess Jack Rollins to some, but Jude is the only one that I think like most casual people, and that's the Cate Blanchett character. You show them a scene of Jude, they're like, oh, it's Bob Dylan. Obviously, that's Bob Dylan, you know? And depending on the scene, yeah. I think people would guess Jack Rollins as well. But other than that, there's nothing that to the layman, you know, Robbie Clark, you're not like, oh, obviously, that's Bob Dylan. No, it's just a dude in the 60s, you know?
He's an actor.
Exactly, he's an actor. And Billy the Kid, certainly not, you know?
Moving on.
I like the Billy Kid stuff way more than seemingly anybody, but
no, I just mean it's a very lot of connect the dots to get you from there.
Oh yeah, yeah, for sure.
Not already in a movie that he knows about Bob Dylan.
Yeah, exactly. And I think you just sort of, the way the movie sort of shows perspective of all these different people, these six different people, even though they are tied together by all of the details that Haynes and Moverman and Christine Vachon, one of the producers, have plucked out of Dylan's life, you aren't told for sure that all of these things are coming from Bob Dylan. And I still don't know, and I've seen this movie like 8 times now, you know, and I think that fragmentation sort of makes it more universal. It makes it more, it allows you to put yourself in the movie more, and it allows you to see all the perspectives that exist in the movie. And I think Claire's perspective is used really well as well, even though she's not really another facet of Dylan. And, you know, you look at the opening credits, right? And it's a lot of shots, of tracking shots, moving from side to side, dolly shots, and it's just different kinds of people staring directly into the camera, right? It's this camera is looking at these people, and these people are also looking at you. And the movie is about all of these different people and how they look at things and how you look at them. And then just the way that they all come together is kind of, you know, human existence. It's interacting with all of these different people that may or may not agree with you about certain things, but there are a few connecting threads between all of them, even though that one of them might just be you're human, you know?
Yeah. And one thing I really liked about that intro that I had sort of forgot about is the use of faces on posters and mannequins and things like that. Like, yeah, we're still getting these representations of people. And, you know, this movie is about so many things, as you said, but it's also about fame. And, you know, we've kind of got these pictures of people right next to living people. And we've got these people that you feel you can interact with. But then we have these people on posters who, you know, they just seem kind of untouchable, and they're who they are. It seems to be kind of stuck in place. And same with the mannequin. It's kind of this thing that you can walk around and look at, but it's not a real person. It's got no facial features. It's something that we understood to be like a person, but isn't a person. And just the idea of celebrity, and especially with Jude Quinn kind of rejecting this image of whatever people want to project on you. I really like the uses of non-human faces and non-living human figures in that intro. And it's something that kind of slipped my mind until just watching it again this week.
Yeah, for sure. And talking about fame, I mean, Robbie is a really good, Heath Ledger's character is a really good representation of somebody that desires fame and then finding out it's not all it's cracked up to be, which you know, is shown, you know, he's a young actor starting out. Grain of Sand is his first big movie. It's the Jack Rollins biopic, and it doesn't end up being the movie that he thought it would be. It doesn't end up being as good as he thought it would be, even though it's a hit and propels him to greater fame. And that fame sort of helps or hurts his life, you know. It is at least part of the reason why he ends up getting a divorce. And you really see that effect that what people think of famous people has on somebody, you know?
Yeah. And I really, it's something else that slipped my mind is I just remembered Robbie Clark as being an actor. I totally forgot, because it had been years since I'd watched this movie, mm-hmm. That he's playing Jack Rollins, that he's playing one of our Dylans. I mean, he's also one of our 6, 7 Dylans, however you want to look at it. but that his springboard into fame was playing this person who at that time in his life was just receiving this big jump up to fame. And so watching that parallel, I thought was interesting too. And it was something that wouldn't needed to really be in there. I mean, he could just be an actor being an actor, playing anybody, yeah, or playing even not a real person at all, just any entirely fictional character. But I really enjoyed that. And I like how they kind of plugged him into our real world, saying he's a Kerouac and a Brando and a Jack Rollins combined. And I thought that was kind of just
James
one
Dean
more touch.
Combined as well.
Right. James yeah. Dean. Yeah. Just one more kind of touch about that kind of one half step away from reality. You know, we've got this actor playing Jack Rollins who is playing, you know, a Bob Dylan version as Christian Bale. Just one other kind of facet of this, you know, multifaceted movie that I enjoyed.
Yeah, for sure. And even like the one thing that I find really interesting about that thread of the movie is that when we first see Robbie, we see a clip, a very short clip of him in the recording studio in the documentary about Jack Rollins, right? But when we first are introduced to Robbie, the character, he's shooting the scene under the billboard of Jack Rollins' face in Grain of Sand. Like, and it's an on-set thing, you know? We're not seeing the actual yeah. finished movie. We're seeing him on set, and that's where him and Claire lock eyes, and then they eventually meet at the diner. But, you know, our introduction to him is him in person at work. And then right at the end of the movie, right before Claire and Robbie see each other for the last time in the movie, obviously they'll see each other again, unless something terrible happens on the boating trip. she is watching, like flipping around or reading, and I think the TV is on, and Grain of Sand is on, and it's that scene, right? And it's now 9 years yeah. later or whatever since they met, and she is now watching this sort of, she's watching Robbie having become what Jack Rollins was in Grain of Sand, right? It's a representation of a moment in her life that she saw from a different perspective, but in a way it's also what that movie did to Jack Rollins, you know? And that's all very pot-heady and stuff, but I thought it was wonderful. I think it's so cool, you know?
Yeah.
And it's the way that these people become immortalized in the span of 9 years sometimes, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, and I think the element of fame is prevalent throughout a lot of these, but one thing that I thought was very cool about Robbie Clark is he seems, you know, he's ultra successful after this movie, and we see that. And but it's so little of the movie, of his section of the movie, is about him interacting with people outside of his immediate circle.
Yeah.
You know, we see him at the movie theater, and we see him at the diner yelling at the photographer and things like that. But it's mostly him at home, or him on the phone with his wife or girlfriend, or him dealing with the divorce, you know, either in the court, in the parking lot. And that's one that's so much about fame, but isn't about his interaction with fame. It's about how his notoriety is affecting the way he deals with the people really close to him. Yeah. It's not him dealing with mobs of fans or him dealing with the media so much. It's just about the way all those interactions have changed him and now affect the way that he deals with the people closest to him. And I thought that was good.
Yeah, absolutely. I concur.
yeah. Who haven't we talked about here? I guess.
I mean, we haven't really talked about Billy, Woody, Arthur. We haven't said a lot about yeah. Jude or Jack. It's kind of been a Robbie fest so far.
yeah, so far. yeah. Well, okay. Well, Jack seems to be the closest just because that's part yeah. of the Robbie Clark story. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, this is a sad one.
I mean, only a little bit. Like he finds happiness. He has to go through it a little bit, but I mean, everybody does a little bit.
Yeah, does he strike you as happy near the end?
No, when was the last time Christian Bale struck you as happy in any performance? He doesn't, like, he might smile in Newsies, but you know it's a lie, you know?
yeah.
There's just something inherently sad about Christian Bale, I think, even though he's also wonderful, you know?
Yeah, I mean, this is a kind of a, I mean, these are all variations on what Bob Dylan could have been or who could have been Bob Dylan, I suppose, but this is the, you know, the Christian phase he went through, if it stuck forever. Mm-hmm. You know, he had we start with him as in the pure, you know, protest finger pointing kind of phase of Bob Dylan's career. Mm-hmm. that very awkward dinner speech that he gives is something taken very much from Dylan's life. This is kind of the alternate reality where that sticks a lot more. Yeah. And the salvation period that he went to through the Slow Train Coming and Saved albums kind of sticks, and he just kind of quietly disappears and has this life as Father John, where he still performs music and still sings, but seems to never really escape that born again phase of his life. Mm-hmm. And I mean, not to say that that's the saddest, it's just kind of one of the quieter stories. I mean, it's not on screen as much either, yeah. But that one's just really bookended. I mean, it's just as he's making him famous in Greenwich Village to, you know, what we imagine the last however many decades of his life would have been in this reality.
Yeah, but it's also it's partially him getting rejected and part of him accepting that rejection and realizing he doesn't really want the world that he was in anymore. You know, it's kind of like if Kanye West after the 2000 after the Taylor Swift thing, he went into the studio to make My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy. It's like if he never came out of the studio, you know, he was just like, you know what, this isn't good for me. I shouldn't be drinking that much Hennessy at award shows. I'm just gonna tap out now, you know. And you know, I think there's some agency in that for Jack/John. You know, I think it's that it's not that the world has defeated him, it's that he's seen enough of the world that he was in to realize it's not for him anymore. And I think that's right. There's a lot of there's a rampant theme of moving on and traveling in this movie and transportation in general. Like, so many of our characters are in modes of transportation so much of the film, you know? And it's just something that continual movement is such a big part of this film. Like, planes, cars for Jude specifically, and Robbie, I guess. And
trains.
Yeah, trains are the most obvious because they're the biggest and most prominent. But yeah, it's transportation and constant movement forward is a big big part of this film. And yeah, it's that's what he does. He just sort of moves on. He presses on, if you will, you know. And it's not necessarily that the world beat him. It's that he decided the world wasn't for him.
Right. And I guess I think part of when I say it's kind of one of the sadder, quieter ones is that it's literally one of the quieter ones. We see the documentary about him being put together and we're watching footage of him as someone else talks about him. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, he's just kind of voiceless. We're watching him perform for part of it and having you know, the people who stand in for the females at that time of his life, mm-hmm. Kind of talk about him. And I think even before the Father John things and the rejection, there's just sort of a very melancholy thing about Christian Bale's performance, more so than I think anybody else in this movie, even though other than, you know, the Woody Guthrie, the Marcus Carl Franklin, mm-hmm. which I mean, has a couple bits of downbeat things. But he, I mean, he's so spry and bouncy for so much of his performance.
Yeah, very, very likable kid.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, there's certainly these kind of downbeat elements to everyone's depiction of him. But I think there's a sad. I mean, just as you said about when's the last time you saw Christian Bale happy? There's a kind of a deep sadness about when he's playing and even when things are going well for him that I think permeates the character.
Yeah, yeah, I would agree. But I mean, in that doc, it's kind of memorializing him in a way, but he gives an interview in that doc. There's a lot of groundwork that introductory that we see in the first part before he disappears. And then we see him reintroduced when he falls on the sidewalk in the rain, looks up, which is not a part of the doc, just part of his story. But then he gives that interview in his office right before he performs Pressing On. And I don't actually know if that's the name of the song. I'm just guessing it is because it seems to be the most prominent lyric. But he gives a brief interview, and that's sort of his signing off in the movie, as that little interview, and then we see a little bit of performance, and that's the last time we see him. And one of the most prominent lyrics, one of the ones that he really hits is "Don't look back." You know, he's moving forward, and it's a part of his moving forward is appearing in this documentary and accepting that that is the past now, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. But yes, Christian Bale, sad person. I think maybe we should we start with Billy? Because like we're almost half an hour into the podcast, which I think is an apt metaphor for how the movie uses Billy the Kid. But he's mentioned early on and then comes into prominence later in the film. Because I think he's really kind of the core of the movie. I think the main lesson of the movie, or the main point of the movie, is in Billy the Kid's story. So I think it makes sense to talk about him before we go any further.
Yeah, I that riles my curiosity, though, how you feel he's the most representative of it. And I feel that, you know, his use as kind of closing the film out, other than the real Bob Dylan, makes it seem like that is the way to take it, that this there's some finality about him, and him being so prominent so late is kind of where the story ends, and kind of the conclusion, or the closing down of this character, and the you know, many Bob Dylan identities kind of wind up with him. So I really do want to know what your take on that is.
Okay, so what you just said is wonderful, because I think like kind of the exact opposite is true of the movie as well. Like it does wind down with him, and I think he is the last voice we hear in the movie. But I think like that's also the beginning of the story, I think, because what we see in Billy's story, and we get like at the end of the end credits, as we're going away from those dolly shots of people looking at the camera, I think the first shot we get is Billy waking up, that close up of his eyes opening, and then we cut to Woody catching a train, right? But we get that quick shot of Woody and of Billy waking up, and then there's later in the film, not too much later, but I think it's maybe during Jude's introduction or some other character's introduction, we see a quick shot of Billy leaving his house. That is then given no context. It's just sort of there. And then later on the film, when he actually does appear, and we see all of that again, him waking up, him leaving, and then his dog Henry running away. We're so much further into the movie, but it sort of helps to keep Billy be a part of the story all throughout, even if it's just in quick what the hell just happened cutaways, you know? And I think Billy's story is all about trying to hold on to something for too long, right? He loves the town of Riddle, which is a composite of various other things, or a compost heap, if you will. But it's just this combination of all of these different influences that come together and form this whole that he has latched onto, that he loves, right? And he is standing up and fighting, or at least protesting in some capacity, to Pat Garrett and the change that is going on around the town, right? But people are running away from this town. People are killing themselves to get out of what's happening. But Billy holds on to it, right? Keeps it in as something that he loves, that he's not ready to let go of. And he gets arrested because of that. And he goes to jail. And so what happens, because he holds on to something for too long, is that he is literally trapped in a cage. And he gets out of jail. Homer helps him break out. And then he hops onto the train, right? He runs away. And I think the lesson from the Billy portion of the movie is that Bob Dylan is one of the key things about Bob Dylan, and one of the things that makes him so interesting is that he continually, like right when you're starting to figure him out, he jumps onto something else, right? Like right when you've sort of got a handle on all the folk stuff, he goes electric. And I think that's something that really is a theme throughout his career, of him doing the unexpected right when you're getting comfortable with what he had started to do before. And I think that's the idea in Billy. And we see so many in every other character in the movie, they're all running from something, you know, they're all feeling trapped in some capacity, and they're all trying to run away. And Billy is just the longest ago portion where this happens, you know, and that it really bleeds into the Woody portion, because Woody, you know, I don't think it's far-fetched to think of the Billy story as all being imagined by Woody, and because a character that is established as a fake, you know, and we see Woody literally stealing in Riddle, and stealing and taking something with him. And what he takes with him is all the stuff that he then recites on the train car earlier in the movie. This movie's impossible to talk about. But I hope you understand what I mean. But I think that's like the main theme, like I said, with all the transportation and traveling that happens in the movie, the main theme is moving forward. And chronologically, that's the first time a character decides he has to move on from something that he loves. And I think it sort of sets the groundwork for every other character, even though it's the last time a character runs away from something.
Yeah, no, the reason I asked that the way it was is because it's not so much about closing down. Like, it's there's this talk that it's, you know, this is Billy the Kid. Pat Garrett chased him down, and you know, we hear earlier in the movie that maybe he just avoided that bullet, or he just played dead, and then he has this whole life after, right?
Yeah.
It's that the whatever negative things are coming towards you got the best of you, and you kind of cut and run. You no longer get to have that old life as Billy the Kid, but you still get to live on, and that's kind of your reward. And so we have him showing up to that speech with the, you know, he puts that mask on. So we have this person who, you know, this is, in my interpretation, this is Billy the Kid. This is someone who was killed by Pat Garrett, or sorry, was perceived to have been killed by Pat Garrett, somehow got away with it, had to leave everything in the past, and kind of starts this new life.
Mm-hmm.
And he sees Pat Garrett again, and, you know, in this new life, yeah, he's found the town of Riddle, and he has all these friends and all these people, and he's got his home and things like that. And he's really kind of grown to love this thing too. And there's kind of a moment where he could have, he kind of confronts the person who took his last pass. You know, he confronts Pat Garrett. Mm-hmm. And he could have got away with it. And he takes off the mask, he gets recognized, and he's put back in jail. And all of these stories, I think, in a way, kind of show someone trying something, kind of getting called out on it or having it catch up with them, and then some negative consequence. Mm-hmm. And then you move on. And it just seems like this one is this idea of Bob Dylan being so prolific, and being such a personal writer, putting himself out there, and then, you know, being rejected or disposed of in one way or the other. You know, we have Jack Rollins making that speech and having everyone kind of boo him and deride him, and kind of has to change his whole life. We have Woody Guthrie thinking he's got away from his past, and the juvenile correction center catches up with them. We have Jude Quinn making up this whole identity, and you know, first he goes electric and is called Judas. And then later on, his real past identity with the yearbook is shown up, and this kind of changes her whole world. It's this idea that after any of these negative experiences, you could just stop. You could just kind of Father John and cut your losses and say that this is it. I'm going to kind of shrink a little bit into obscurity, continue to live, continue to make things, continue to do things, but kind of not put myself out there in such a way. And for me, that's the kind of the grandest one, where someone makes the choice to do something in such danger.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he takes off that mask to someone who, you know, had been trying to kill him and thought he did kill him, and then gets put in jail. And then, as you said, Homer sets him free, and he's escaping once again to go start somewhere new. And then Henry, his dog, starts chasing him, and that there are these things in this old life that could be there. If you decide to just stay, you're going to have this awesome thing. You're going to have this person or this dog or this career, or, you know, this to be on the cutting edge of this burgeoning subculture, and to really be that guy. If you just stay there, there's this thing that you're going to love, that you've worked for, that you really do deserve, but you just kind of choose to move on. And that's, you know, that's him leaving Henry behind. That's him unmasking himself, but you know, for the risk of it, and then being caught, and then kind of takes the next move and says, well, this is it for me here. I've got to leave everything that's good behind and start somewhere fresh. And we see variations of that theme, I think, at the end of almost every one of these stories.
Yeah, for sure. I agree. And one of the things I enjoy about Henry as well is the idea of that sort of being... I mean, Henry is the person or person, the living thing that Billy seems to be the closest to. And Henry runs away the first second he gets a chance. And I think that's sort of like, as soon as the door opens, Henry takes off, and Henry is going to do his own thing. And I think that's pretty representative of how at least I perceive Bob Dylan's creative interests to be. Like, it's just something pops into his head and he's like, I'm gonna do it, you know, and he's gonna change up my style in this way. And it's just sort of like it's another instance of something just running wild, you know.
Yeah, and this gets to something I did want to ask you about, this format being applied to Bob Dylan. Is he the best candidate for something like this? Because, you know, we see the big jumps here. We see protests, and, you know, he says he's not going to do those finger pointing songs anymore. And then, you know, he gets away from folk and he's got something electric. Does that continue throughout his career in such a meaningful way? I was just thinking about people like David Bowie who make new identities and kind of pursue significantly different things. Does this format of this unique kind of biopic format apply best to Bob Dylan, or would it fit better with someone else? Or is it so much about changing your musical style frequently, or is it something else?
I think it's that, I mean, when you think of prominent artists changing their musical style in a very drastic way, the two that come to mind for me are the Beatles and even more so Bob Dylan. And I think just like the resonance of the Newport Folk Festival performance, at least like in the minds of people that think about culture, like, it just resonates so much that it has a bigger effect on how we think about Bob Dylan in general. Like, all the other jumps seem bigger because of just the way that this one jump was perceived and seen at the time. And I do think that sort of is a shadow that looms large over all of these other shifts. But I mean, to guess whether or not this is the best subject for this type of movie or anything regarding Bob Dylan, I don't think I can answer that question, because I don't think I know enough about Bob Dylan to compare him to other people. But I think one of the things that this movie does really well that I think allows it to be interesting to somebody like myself, who in 2007 had no interest in Bob Dylan and now has more of an interest in it because of the movie, is that it's very deep cutty, you know, like, it's all like little details. And like I said, outside of Jude and Jack, there are a few moments in this movie where you're watching and being like, oh yeah, this is about Bob Dylan for sure. You know, it's all these little things, like the way people dress in Riddle, like how that's kind of the Rolling Thunder review, I think it was called, like, it's elements of that. And Todd Haynes and company, like the way that they use all of these little details and sort of throw them in throughout the movie, it's able to simultaneously capture Bob Dylan while also not alienating people like me that don't know a lot about him, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that that's super important to how I've received the movie.
Yeah. Well, and I think you're certainly right that there's no, I brought up David Bowie just because, you know, he died kind of recently and he's been known for having different identities, but.
And Todd Haynes made a movie about him.
Yeah, it's true.
But it's very much in the vein of I'm Not There, like the way it jumps around and is fragmented. Anyway, sorry.
Yeah, no, but just, I mean, you know, Bowie going from Ziggy Stardust to Aladdin Sane, things like that, none of those come close to a three-word shorthand of Dylan goes electric. Like, yeah. That's still, as you said, I mean, that jump is just one of the biggest ones you can point to, and tons of people have changed their style significantly throughout their careers, but I just don't think any of them hold up as so important, just because he was, you know, the face of that subgenre, kind of pushed it away so famously. had such a backlash to it. And as we see in Jude Quinn's, you know, thread in this story, it brought up all these other questions of, do you think folk has failed? Do you no longer believe in any of these things that you've talked about? Do you think that the youth movement can no longer have any impact? I still don't think that, you know, Bowie will wear different clothes and makeup. There's a lot of things you can point to about changes in any musician's identity, but I don't think any of them really have that significance, as you said, of that one live show changing so much.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I was thinking about, I just don't think it's possible for anything like that to really happen again, is that? Like, no. Because I was thinking about that a lot today, and I was trying to think of the closest thing to a modern example of it. And I think, like, the closest thing I could come up with was Kendrick Lamar doing To Pimp a Butterfly, lyrically is pretty in line with, what should come next for Kendrick Lamar, but musically is just like a crazy album and totally different from Good Kid, Mad City, which is has a little bit of dalliance into the more abstract, but is nothing like To Pimp a Butterfly, which is a very odd, very jazzy sort of album. And people pretty quickly accepted it as great, you know, and I was one of them, you know, and it took me about 5 songs to wrap my head around it, but by track 6, I was super on board. And I just don't think that type of thing is possible, partially due to the advances in music and the fact that you can do so much in Pro Tools and stuff, and also just the fact that of the way culture reacts to things quicker. And there's no way that there could be like a slow spread of the news of Kendrick Lamar goes jazz as like like Dylan goes electric, you know?
Yeah, and culture is just so fragmented now. No one's ever going to be able to make impacts. And that's not just Dylan going electric. That's so many things that happened when culture is more unified.
Yeah, absolutely.
I do really love the electric scene though, and the gunshots and the sounds of the guitar cases opening. I think that's put together so well.
Yes, there are so many instances of really wonderful filmmaking in this movie, and that's definitely one of them. Todd Haynes, super talented dude.
Any other that you want to point out at this moment?
I mean, there's a lot.
We haven't been talking too technical about it, really.
Yeah. Well, the thing, part of this movie that's really impressive to me, and I only noticed it like the last viewing I gave it, is that it's a really small movie that feels really grand. Like, most of the movie is told in close-ups. There's not a lot of wide shots. But it still feels so... I remember the first time I watched it this year, which is the first time I watched it in like 8 years, watching it and being like, looking up the budget and being like, holy shit, I can't believe they pulled that off for that amount of money. And I still have that feeling, and it does feel like a much grander movie than its budget, but it is also very close-up heavy and all that stuff. Riddle is kind of the only place where you get a lot of wide shots. But it's just like all really well done segments. And part of it is all the music that Haynes had access to. And but there's also all these little small moments. Like, I think when Woody is first asked for his story right near the beginning, and you know, what brought you here, I think, is the question from the two guys in the freight car that leads him to it. And he just says carelessness and looks out the train car, and we get this sort of this pan over to the grass while the focus changes, and we get entirely out of the train car. Like, that shot is just so gorgeous and perfect and simple, very simple but beautiful. And and then the quick montage where he's the geek in a cage at one point, and you know, gorgeous church says secrets are for keeping, all that part is so well done and very quick, and there are lots of instances of that throughout the movie. I think the stylistic high point of the movie is definitely the Ballad of the Thin Man though. That sequence is amazing.
It's flashy, but it's very good. Like,
it's so good.
Yeah, it's one that actually tries for a lot. I mean, that happens in Riddle, I think, too. And what you said about the budget, I would wonder. I'm a firm believer in endings having a big effect on your your lasting opinion of it. Mm-hmm. And I think this movie feels so weird and grand both because of ending with Riddle. I mean, I know it's not the very last thing we see is a draft or anything, but mm-hmm. I think having so much of that stuff so late in the movie and just going from some of the black and white stuff to this really vivid, bright Riddle scenes, I think makes it feel grander and more expansive and like more of a wild movie. This was always going to be a wild movie without Riddle, of just having five or six Dylans mm-hmm. and just covering different narratives like that. But I think Riddle is the one that really kind of kicks it over the edge.
Yeah, I would agree. And I agree. But yeah, very grand movie, very wonderful. One thing I wanted to talk to, I mean, we haven't talked about Keenan Jones, and I find him an interesting presence in the movie, Bruce Greenwood in general. And when I say Keenan Jones, I'm also including Pat Garrett, also played by Bruce Greenwood. I'm curious to
in
know
the what, most cl-
sorry
the Cloud Atlas portion of this film.
I'm curious to know what you thought about him in the movie, and also just in general the way the movie portrays criticism.
I really like him in this one.
Well, he's good in everything, but
yeah, that's true. I like him a lot in this one. I think that those scenes with he and Jude's interview, especially in the car and things like that, I think that it's I really like them, and I think I mean obviously we haven't probably haven't even said Kate Blanchett's name yet, but
Kate Blanchett is fucking amazing in this movie, and it almost doesn't even isn't worth mentioning because literally everybody agrees about that.
Yeah, I know. I don't think I could mention it without mentioning.
Yeah, Kate Blanchett's probably really nitpicky. Like, I would imagine anybody that's as good as their job as Kate Blanchett is probably really nitpicky about their work. And even she probably watches this movie. Is like, yeah, kind of nailed it. You know?
Yeah, I know. It sounds so redundant to even mention it, but she's next level fantastic in this. Yeah. Like, just undeniably.
Yeah.
Fuck, when a performance is that good that it doesn't even need mentioning.
Yeah, anyway, exactly.
No, I really enjoy those two together. I think it's a kind of contentious point for the viewer because people watching this are likely Dylan fans. I think you're supposed to like him. I think that there are certain scenes in this movie or certain threads. I think Heath Ledger's depiction isn't that sympathetic. I don't think we like him very much at that point. At least I don't for stretches of it. And yeah, I mean, Jude is just a contrarian. And I find myself agreeing with Keenan Jones at certain points of this movie. You know, you say you don't care about anything, but it's quite clear you care about being self-conscious. And just he's got, you know, a face, a head of hair and a voice and an accent that brings just a ton of gravitas.
Yeah.
Just that's who he is. And it's played very well in this. And then we have this very, thin, fidgety, seemingly uncertain Jude Quinn. And I really like their parts together. I mean, I think that, you know, I find myself at least kind of bouncing back and forth between them. About who I agree with or who I like more at a certain time. And I think it's good. And we kind of expect Bruce Greenwood to do, or Keenan Jones, I guess, to do something worse. I mean, I know he bribed someone at a certain point, but you kind of get this feeling that there's going to be a moment where he's just a big piece of shit. And so it's easier to hate him and it's easier to like Jude Quinn by juxtaposition. And we never really get that. And I really do enjoy that there is a fair bit of play there and you kind of get left to make up your own mind because Jude Quinn sometimes annoys me and Jude Quinn sometimes is completely understandable in his reactions. And just kind of being put under this microscope is something I can never, I'll never experience. And just watching someone deal with that in a way that you don't always agree with isn't always the most likable way to do it, but really highlights the fact that it's such an insane position. And I think that, you know, just the level of play between the two, I think works very well. And I think that they both, I mean, I obviously Kate Blanchett's wonderful, but again, I think Bruce Greenwood really gets overshadowed because barring that one riddle scene, he does nothing other than play with Blanchett.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's kind of the straight man in the comedy sort of thing. It's that he never has a chance to be the most interesting part of a scene, you know?
No.
Yeah. And
is there anything you want to pinpoint about Blanchett being that good, or is it just kind of everything? Let's move on.
I mean, and it's weird because one of the things that bugs me about biopics is people doing impressions of other actors and just like kind of nailing it because they're able to look at the tape. And that's exactly what Cate Blanchett does. Like, I mean, I had No Direction Home on at the office today and hadn't seen it before. And which is Martin Scorsese's, I think, 2005 doc about Bob Dylan. And there's a scene where I think he's even playing Ballad of a Thin Man on the piano, and like the way his hand comes up after he hits the keys, and it's one of my favorite parts of Cate Blanchett's performance. I was like, it's really cool that she does that. I bet she saw that somewhere. And then I saw exactly what she probably saw, you know, like that footage from Meet the Document. And and that's the thing that I hate, that Cate Blanchett also somehow does well enough that I don't hate it anymore. It's just like how Todd Haynes does a biopic. Like, he takes this thing that I hate and makes it into probably one of my 30 favorite movies, which sounds like a big number, but like when you think about how many goddamn movies I've seen, like, that's pretty amazing, you know?
That is the top 1%.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't know, it's just there's just this constant thread of doing something that's been done before, but doing it just a little bit better than everybody else, you know? And, or I would say a lot better than everybody else in this case, but, and that is able to set it apart from everything that came before it. And I'm sure there would be music critics that would say the same about Bob Dylan's approach to folk music, Bob Dylan's approach to rock music, you know? And, yeah, and I think it's so cool the way that Cate Blanchett is able to simultaneously do a really good impression but also feel like a character, you know?
Yeah, no, 100%. Yeah. I was going to make that point about Dylan. It's just, it wasn't that if you took out his lyrics, it's not as though, and for the most part, I mean, I think there's a lot of good, you know, just music in Dylan's career. Yeah. But if you were to play some Dylan albums with other lyrics, people wouldn't notice it as that much different or that much better than what's being done at the time. But there's just a lyricism and performance element to it that made it that much better. And this is a movie of people being Bob Dylan, but then Cate Blanchett was Bob Dylan.
Yeah.
So it's just kind of that three leaps above that kind of transcends. And I think she has some advantages. You know, I don't want to take anything away from this performance, which I've just said.
She gets the most fun version for sure.
Well, she gets the most fun version, and she gets, you know, pretty much the closest to Dylan. You know, Christian Bale gets Dylan, as we said. And
oh, and he's so good in that TV interview, the black and white one, where he's just awkwardly sitting in the chair being interviewed by the host with his microphone, his harmonica and the guitar. Anyway, so.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess Ben Whishaw gets pretty close.
Yeah.
To being Bob Dylan, but it's so small, and he does so little just because he was given so little.
Yeah.
But I mean, we get the longest stretch too. I mean, it's right in the meatiest part of the movie, and we stay with her longer than we stay with anybody by a long shot. So, and kind of has some of the touchstone Dylan moments that people who know a bit about them might recognize. So
yeah,
I think she has some advantages, but that doesn't explain everything.
Yeah, exactly.
Her not being talented.
I mean, just in her last scene when she looks at the camera, like, it's just so arresting. Like, just the way she looks at the camera, it's so, I don't know. It's just like, it's this totally earned moment that's earned by her and Todd Haynes that, I don't know. I just find it so affecting. And there are a handful of moments like that in the movie. I mentioned the carelessness portion where we see a bit of a montage with Woody. I really enjoy Billy saying how he never had the knack for any sort of musical instrument. Probably a handful of others that are just slipping my mind right now. But it's just these little small moments that I think just hit so hard. And Cate Blanchett's being the biggest one for me. But just going back to the relationship with Mr. Jones, I really enjoy the way criticism is portrayed in the movie, because I think the end point of the movie is that all of the, well, specifically Jude and Billy, but Bob Dylan by proxy, kind of needs somebody to push them forward, right? Because we've talked about how it's all about moving on from what you had previously, or at least that's sort of my take on it. And we see Pat Garrett being the reason that Billy the Kid has to move on. And Keenan Jones is able to push and push and push Jude Quinn to such an extent over and over again. But eventually, in that last scene, what we see, that scene I was just talking about where Cate Blanchett looks at the camera, it's still set up like an interview. It's just much more relaxed than all the interviews that have come before it. And Jude is talking about folk music, the nature of folk music and all that stuff. And there are two moments where he sort of like runs out of things to say. He's thinking of what the word is. And then we cut to Keenan Jones in the studio saying, and contradictions is one of them, and chaos is the second time he speaks. But they're in two different locations. They're clearly talking to each other, but they also are kind of on the same wavelength, right? And so it's just sort of, I think it's the artist coming to grips with the critic and the fact that artists for the most part hate critics. And I just read A.O. Scott's book, Better Living Through Criticism, so this is very on my mind. But it like historically, critics are very important to how artists get remembered. Like, I think, at least in my head, the way Bob Dylan is going to be remembered and has been remembered is the just this sort of amalgamation of all these influences and all the things that have fascinated him. And I mean, I think that's very present in I'm Not There. And to book drop again, I read Bob Dylan in America by Sean Wilentz, and that's basically the thesis of this book. And it's really interesting because it focuses on the least talked about, but lesser talked about portions of his career. Like, it doesn't talk about the first time he goes to Newport Film or Folk Festival, or sorry, the Goes Electric time. It talks when he goes back in like 2004. You know, and it's all these really interesting moments in his career that I've never heard anything about. But and just sort of the way that critics or people that think about what you do, they get it wrong, and this will, or sorry, they don't see it the way you see it, and this will haunt you forever. Like, the seven steps to remaining in hiding or whatever is never, one of them's never be creative or never create anything, because it will haunt you. It will be perceived improperly. Like, I'm messing it up, but you know what I mean? But eventually it does help you push forward. You know, Keenan Jones helps push forward Jude to an extent, and criticism in general helps the artist. Like, Grail Marcus is going to be very important to how Bob Dylan is remembered, because he's written like 4,000 books about him, and is generally regarded as the best music critic still alive. And I just really enjoyed the way that the movie showed that, you know. And even I'm Not There is sort of a like subtle act of criticism, in that it's sort of critiquing what Todd Haynes thinks Bob Dylan represents. And I think it's really cool that a movie is able to do that. And it's cool. I don't know.
I think kind of to that point, one of the things that works out so well for the Jude Quinn version is that she's the one that dies young. And I think kind of gets beyond that, you know, kind of the more, you know, to go with Rimbaud's thing, just not creating in public. And, you know, he has created in public, but then there's this cutoff point, and then critics can form their opinions about you, but there's kind of this lesser amount to deal with. And so I think in that way, Jude would be remembered even better than, you know, the Jude that lives on until they're 70. And yeah. I think it's kind of interesting that I think what everyone would likely be everyone or most people's favorite thread of this movie is Jude Quinn. And that's the one that kind of dies young.
Yeah.
And we can kind of stop things there. And, critics are so important, and but at the same time, when there's less to critique, there's, you know, there's kind of that air about someone that there's not that much that can be said, and the more that gets said about them, the more that gets taken away from them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
One thing that I noticed in this movie that I thought kind of popped up a few times that I hadn't seen a lot of other places is, you know, and I think this even goes in with representing Dylan through these different characters, is that if the Bob Dylan that we know and love hadn't existed, that someone else would do it, that the kind of the subculture that he was a part of and ended up really pushing to the forefront, or, you know, climbing to the top of, you know, that movement, if you want to call it that, was so powerful that it kind of had to have its figure. It kind of had to have that person on top that embodied it. And that if Bob Dylan didn't do it, someone else would have done it. Maybe there's a Jude Quinn that really would have done it. Maybe there was a woman who would have done it. Maybe there was all these, you know, a younger person, an older person, someone that would have done it. And I think one of the things about biopics is talking about these people that they're so singular, and that they're these outliers, and that they're the ones that really push this thing forward, and that without them, their movement or their subculture wouldn't be at the forefront of the popular psyche. And I think this movie kind of plays with that a little bit, and I think that sort of demythologizes Dylan a little bit, but I don't know if that's quite what the goal is, or if that's really the way other people see it. I it just seems so kind of antithetical to the subgenre of the biopic to say that this person was great, but if they hadn't existed, someone else would have filled that void and they would have been great too. Or there's kind of this vacant spot for greatness to grow out of anything with this much energy behind it. I want your take on that and where this movie falls in with that idea.
I mean, I don't really have much of a different take from you. I think you are right. I think there would be differences. You're right that someone would have filled that spot in culture. It wouldn't have been the exact same way, you know? But there would have been a Bob Dylan whether or not Robert Zimmerman decided to become a musician, you know? So, yes, I think you are right, you know? And you're right that it's interesting that idea is contained in a movie that very much mythologizes Dylan. And
where do you see it show up in this movie?
I mean, just the fact that, I mean, I hadn't really thought of it until you mentioned it in an email 6 hours ago or whatever, however long ago it was. And then just reading it, I was just like, yeah, that's interesting and probably right, you know? So I guess I haven't thought about it all that much, you know? I just sort of think that, that's a very James thought that I generally agree with, but might not have come to on my own, you know? And in this case, did not. Like, I think the way that the movie demythologizes Dylan, I think, is mostly in the, I think there's a lot in the Robbie Clark part, right? It's that being famous isn't all that it's cracked up to be. And it's also, we see primarily his domestic life and the crumbling of his domestic life, you know? So I think that's a lot of the demythologizing right there. And also the second half of Jack Rollins. So those are the things that I think are the most demythologizing off the top of my head.
All right.
Yeah.
We got anything else but I'm not there?
Yeah, I think I just want to point out a couple more filmmaking things that are really cool.
Please.
To me.
There just hasn't been a ton. So.
Yeah, well, and also there's, really quickly, they shoot on so many different formats in this movie. There's 16mm, Super 8 16mm, 35mm for the majority of it, black and white film stock, color film stock, all these different things that all sort of are difficult to combine, and they do a really good job of it. And it's a very difficult thing to do. I know I haven't attempted it, but I know enough that that I know it's difficult and is cool that they tried it, and it's cool that they pulled it off. But structurally, one of the things I really enjoy about the way the movie works, even though it is so fragmented, as we've said myriad times throughout this podcast, like a lot of the times. Or a lot of the characters, actually all of the characters, sort of their ending in this movie is very similar to their beginning. Like there's a long theme of things looping around. And even though we're trying to continually move forward, things do kind of end up coming back to where they were. And I think that's really cool. Like, and some characters even tie together, like Woody his beginning is him catching the train, right? Which also might as well be, which is also Billy's ending, right? So those two characters, I think, are really well linked. And also the fact that Woody's last scene is him literally running into Billy, you know? And chronologically, the movie begins with Billy waking up, right? And then running into Billy. Oh, anyways, let's not talk about the timeline. It's impossible. But like, you know, with Jude is another good example, or is the best example, I think. Because you get the opening of Jude on the motorcycle. It's very Lawrence of Arabia, which begins with somebody driving a motorcycle too quickly. And that's our introduction to Jude. And then we see the corpse and the Kris Kristofferson intro, voiceover intro. But then when Jude's story begins improper, we see it's the scene that plays off the opening of 8 and a half. We see a traffic jam and, Jude, we're getting, I can't remember if it's POV, but just very disorienting stuff. Where it seems like Jude has to be brought back to life. Like Jude is dying. Jude is trapped here. He's trapped in this traffic jam and can't quite get out, you know? And then immediately we go to the press conference where we get a lot of dishonest answers, right? The ending for Jude's character is that car interview, where it's another similar setup to the press conference, but we're getting honest answers and it's a much more relaxed situation. And her and Keenan Jones are, or him and Keenan Jones are thinking on the same wavelength, even though they're not physically in the same space. And then we also have the mirror of the Lawrence of Arabia motorcycle stuff coming back at the end. And I just sort of think that it's really interesting that even though this movie is about moving forward, it's still about these things that still exist within you. You know, even though you've moved on, you still kind of come back to the same place. And I think that's cool. Like, we already talked about this with the Robbie story, our introduction to him being him on set filming this scene. And one of the last things we see right before he drives away from Claire is Claire watching him on TV, like that scene, you know? And the way these things sort of loop around back on themselves, I think is so cool. And with the movie itself, like the beginning, the ending, and the Ballad of the Thin Man portion comes right in the middle of the movie. But the opening of the movie is this backstage point of view from what we can figure out as Bob Dylan, right? Walking up to the stage, just a standard backstage walking up to the stage. And really cool way to start the movie, visually very beautiful, and is sort of our introduction to the film. And then in the middle, we get a POV shot from Jones, from Mr. Jones in the Ballad of a Thin Man portion. And, you know, we for the first time see things from his perspective, and he starts to feel trapped like Jude has felt trapped, you know, and he's trying to get out of this place. He doesn't really get out of it, you know, because that sequence ends with Jude performing. And then one of the last shots the second last shot in the movie is another piece of archival footage. And what we're now getting is the perspective of the audience, right? It's a camera walking through a crowd from the perspective of somebody trying to get closer to the stage. And then we get that shot, that close up of Bob Dylan playing the harmonica, which is the very last shot of the movie. And so we get this person trying to get close to the stage. And just as the song is ending, I mean, when you think about most of Bob Dylan's songs, they end in a harmonica solo that fades out. And as this person's getting close to the stage, the person that they are trying to get closer to fades away. And it's just all, it ends up being this really, even though it's three very quick things, it ends up being this very cool, succinct look at what draws us to famous people. It's, or what makes us like them so much. It's that we want to be able to get close enough to know them, and we want to be able to get close enough to figure out. And that is not possible. They will fade out just as we're getting closer close enough to the stage to actually see them. And I think that's the main idea of I'm Not There that I find so interesting, is that celebrities aren't knowable. People aren't even totally knowable a lot of the times. Like, people in your life will surprise you even when you are as close to them as you can be. And it's just this thing that you can never totally know anything, and it will always fade away right when it's in your grasp. And I think that's a really beautiful thing that the movie accomplishes, and I think it does it in such a spectacular way that, as I said, it is definitely one of my 30 favorite movies, you know, if not if not higher up than that, you know. It's just, I don't want to be accidentally hyperbolic, you know.
So yeah, no, I think that's exactly it. And reading what Haynes wrote about the movie after the fact, I think that's very much what he was going for. I think it's illustrated very well.
Yeah, and it's just so upsetting to me that he had to wait 7 years between, or 8 years between making I'm Not There and Carol. And I know he made Mildred Pierce in the middle, but I mean, this is just one of the things I will never understand about all. Well, I mean, I understand it. I wish rich people understood that they should just fucking throw money at Todd Haynes, you know, in a respectful, artful way to help him make his next picture, you know?
Yes, of course.
Yeah.
I'm not saying
he's the geek in the cage here, all right? but yeah, no, it's even though he'll never make anything better that I'm Not There, he should be given the money to try whatever he feels he has an idea worth it, you know? So.
All right. Want to record 6 more of these and release them piece by piece?
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, we'll start that next week.
Once upon a time, you dressed so fine, threw the bumps of dime in your prime. Then you. People call, say beware doll, you're bound to fall, you thought they were all kidding you. You used to laugh about everybody that was hanging out. Now you don't talk so loud. Now you don't seem so proud about having to be scrounging your next meal. How does it feel? How does it feel to be without a home? Like a complete unknown. Like a rock. Lonely, but you know you only used to get juiced in it. Nobody's ever taught you how to live out on the street, and now you're gonna have to get used to it. You say you never compromise with a mystery tramp, but now you realize he's not selling any. As you stare into the vacuum of his eyes and say, do you want to make a deal? How does it feel? How does it feel to be on your own with no direction? Shouldn't let other people get your kicks for you. You used to ride on a chrome horse with your diplomat, who carried on his shoulder a Siamese cat. Ain't it hard when you disappear? discover that he really wasn't where it's at. After he took from you everything he could steal, how does it feel? How does it feel to have you on your own with no direction home, like a complete unknown, like a rolling stone? Ah, princess on a steeple and all the pretty people they all drinking, thinking that they got it made, exchanging all precious gifts. But you better take your diamond ring, you better pawn it, babe. You used to be so amused at Napoleon in rags and the language that he used. Go to him now, he calls you, you can't refuse. When you ain't got nothing, you got nothing to lose. You're invisible now, you got no secrets to conceal.